Make a link from the past to the future, and we had no discussion, so I tried to kind of simulate a discussion about what could we have been discussing after the talks of Lev Manovich and Mark Rees to connect now to Charlie Deere. I think it is interesting that Mark had this idea of sharing, which is related to the function of distributing and communication, which is one of the side of what media can do. And that Lev Manovich was much more about the production and reception side of media, yeah? That you have a multimedia content that is produced and seen at the same time, something that was pretty separate in the age of photography and film. You had to wait to develop, and then you could only see the product, so you can do that all now in one flow. And there's this other part of connecting and relating in a much more society-based model. Both things have deep roots in art history. And there is this question of art as a communication model, and there is this question of art as a distribution, of a production and reception model. And the astonishing thing is, if we look at the displays of art museums and art galleries today, or at the model of the art market and art criticism, these incredible changements that have been described by the two lecturers before the break, they leave no trace in the function and the basic structure of the art world. And maybe that is something that Charlie Deere is still going to talk about, you know. So we're shifting now, at least in the concept that Günther Reisinger developed, from this field of visionary media and of utopian possibilities and implementations into really use of media, to the confrontation of these fields and these possibilities with the functioning system of art, which is astonishingly unchanged since the early times of the 20th century. This at least is my opinion. But Charlie Deere covers a much broader field. He has added on also in his publications a lot to this more historical visionary side, writing about the computer as an irrational cabinet, for example, which was his PhD, and being the chair of the Computers and the History of Art Group, the CHART conference that every year happens in London. This time it's about the fire of digital archives, is that right?
Yeah. Digital archive fever, yeah.
Digital archive fever, yeah, right. So there is this visionary side also in his writing, and which he has been tracing back the relation of art and media up to Samuel Morse, something, an interest that we share, by the way, at Morse as the artist becoming a telegraphy inventor in the mid-19th century. So today he is going to talk about something which Verena, you and I have experienced, the problem how art can fit into the gallery or doesn't fit into the gallery or doesn't want to fit in the gallery and probably never will. And this is this ongoing conflict we have all suffered through, and I have had so many discussions about that that I said I'm never going to discuss that with an artist anyway. because it's always between vision and complaints, this relation, you know. So I wonder what you're going to make out of it. Yeah. Okay, Charlie.
Okay, thank you. And thank you very much for inviting me to this conference. I'm very excited to be here for the first time at Ars Electronica. I hate this, by the way, these, you know, two fat blokes on either side of me. We won't worry about that. Okay, so I will just start. And net art has always had an awkward relationship with the museums in general, or galleries in general. And my sense is that at the moment it cannot properly be incorporated into the gallery. It does not fit into the kind of spaces, both actual and conceptual, that the gallery traditionally makes available for works of art, usually understood as static, unitary objects intended for passive contemplation by the viewer. Even video art, having once been a practice involving both a forceful critique of both the gallery as a space and mass media from which it emerged, has now largely degenerated, in my view, into another form of production of static objects, more or less static objects with a certain amount of movement, to be passively contemplated in the black cube space of the gallery. And as such, video art has been easily subsumed into the gallery. Net art, by contrast, has failed, for the moment at least, to make whatever adjustments are needed to make it a gallery-friendly practice. At the same time, net art cannot be completely ignored. Even if it cannot fully be incorporated into the gallery, it also cannot be entirely excluded. Thus, it enjoys a curiously ambiguous position, neither properly inside nor properly outside the gallery, but somewhere oscillating on the edge. And for me, this is closely related to the fact that net art is very much part of what we might call the new regime of telecommunications, the new electronic space, the space of television, cinema, telephone, videos, fax, email, hypertext, and the internet, that according to the literary critic J. Hillis Miller has, quote, profoundly altered the economies of the self, the home, the workplace, the university, and the nation-state's politics, which have been traditionally ordered around the firm boundaries of an inside-outside dichotomy. And you can add to that list that Hillis Miller makes of the museum and the gallery as well, as being ever examples of these modern inside-outside spaces. Or in other words, goodbye privacy. As another product of this dichotomy, the gallery and museum is profoundly challenged by the implications of net-based art and all that it implies, and which in turn confound these inside-outside divisions. Thus, it is not perhaps surprising that museums and galleries, or galleries in particular, have so far had difficulty in engaging with net-based art, beyond the largely surmountable practical problems such work presents. It brings radically into question the role and continued existence of the gallery in this new regime of telecommunications. I am going to examine some of the issues around this question, not actually in terms of net art itself, but in terms of an older example of a certain kind of practice that prefigures net art, that of mail art, and in particular the work of the Japanese conceptual artist On Kawara, whose postcard and telegram works that went from the 60s to the 70s prefigure many of the issues at stake, and also through the idea of Jacques Derrida, who, like Ted Nelson, is a kind of deconstructionist postmodernist. Ho, ho, ho. And it's actually this one of the principal objects of Jacques Derrida's deconstruction has been this notion of a kind of inside-outside dichotomy, a certain kind of binary opposition upon which a large number of the metaphysical assumptions which have governed modernity have been grounded. Okay. I'm not going to say any more about that because it's not a lecture on Derrida, unfortunately, but other things. So as part of this long lifetime process of the deconstruction of these kinds of dichotomies, these binary oppositions, in 1980, Derrida published a book entitled La Carte Postale, the postcard, that's the translation, the first part of which, Envoie, was in the form of a series of picture postcards, supposedly sent by possibly Derrida, to an unnamed correspondent, or correspondents, who seemed at least to be, someone whom it seemed at least to be the originated letter's lover. Derrida warns his anonymous correspondent that, quote, you understand within every sign already, every mark or every trait, there is distancing. The post, what there has to be, so it's legible for another than you or I or me, and everything is messed up in advance, cards on the table. By this, Derrida means that any communication is always already open and open to misinterpretation, other kinds of interpretation, other kinds of meanings, that there's never a single transmission of meaning from one person to another in a straightforward way. So Derrida's use of the postcard as a kind of anti-metaphysical gesture has a number of precedents in 20th century art, with those wishing to deconstruct, perhaps, the presumptions and practices of art, including, for example, in this slide, the futurists, who sent postcards as artworks on the front in the First World War. Marcel Duchamp, who produced a piece of art in 1916 made of four postcards sent to his neighbour with grammatically correct nonsense language. Perhaps more famously, Fluxus, perhaps one of the most famous of the anti-art groups of the post-war era, among whose strategies was the employment of the postal service, both as a means of communication between the various artists who were internationally distributed in Germany, Japan, and the United States, and so forth, but also as a form of art making, and not just a means of the art, a sort of a substrate for the art, but actually a means of art making itself. Okay, and in a way, perhaps most famously or infamously, I'm sure many of you have heard of him, Ray Johnson, the founder of the New York Correspondence School, one of the great male artists, and somebody who I could equally have talked about other than on Kawara, but I've chosen Kawara. And in many ways, for me, this kind of practice is as interesting and as relevant a prefiguring of the issues and practices of net art as the more technically obvious are. And I think there are many lessons to be learned from examining male art as a kind of prefiguring. And I think there are direct and indirect correspondences between these earlier practices and net art now. Okay. So to turn to On Kawara, in 1968, Kawara sent a series of postcards stamped from wherever he was at that time of the day with a stamped message detailing the time he got up that day, along with the address of where he was staying, often a hotel in a remote location. As you see here, it says, "I got up at 12:11 p.m. Extremely late in my view, but there you go. And he's staying in a hotel in South America. Of course, 68 is the year that Cybernetic Serendipity, the exhibition was on the ICA in London. It's a year before the ARPANET gets founded. It's 3 years after Ted Nelson invents the term hypertext. Is that right? 65? 8 years. Many apologies, Ted. 8 years after. And so it's absolutely at a certain moment where the very beginnings of the technological shifts that we are now enjoying, or enjoying if that's the right word, we are now enduring perhaps, begins to emerge, begins to become visible. Kawara is perhaps most famous for his series of simple monochrome canvases, usually, though not always, white on black, which feature the date in the language and style of the country he's in, and parts of a local newspaper from the same day fold in the back of the canvas. He's been working on these since 1966. He's also made a series of works using telegrams. On the 5th December 1969, he sent a telegram as part of his contribution to the 18 Paris 470 exhibition. The text read, "I am not going to commit suicide. Don't worry." 3 days later, he sent another text with a text reading, "I am going to commit suicide. Worry." Finally, on the 11th December, he sent a third reading, "I am going to sleep. Forget it." These telegrams led to another series, starting in 1970, all this time all bearing the same message, "I am still alive." And these are actually some of my absolutely favourite works of art of all time. So my wife just does not understand. Kawara's telegrams express, with a telegrammatic economy of means, ideas very similar to those of Derrida. In his ironic gesture of declaring his continuing existence, Kawara's telegrams perfectly exemplify Derrida's analysis of the structure of writing and, by extension, all discourse, and its necessary relation to absence and thus death. According to our common sense conceptions of presence and the present, in order to be able to make any statement of this, any statement at all, let alone one saying, "I am still alive," it is necessary to still be alive and not dead. Thus, when Kawara composed and sent these messages, we have presumed that he was still alive, and it had necessarily at the time to be true. But Kawara's unique testimony to his continued existence at a certain moment, even before it is repeated and before it takes a form of a telegram, is already bound up with technological reproduction. Even before it takes a form of a telegram message, and inasmuch as it is necessarily capable of repetition and iteration, Kawara's testimony to his continued existence implies the possibility of the opposite, that he might in fact be dead. The possibility of his being dead, even if his statement circulates, is a structural necessity for the statement of his continued existence to communicate at all. One day, indeed, these statements are likely to be visible, for example, on the walls of an art gallery, when their message is, in a literal sense, no longer true. Kawara will be dead. He may already be dead for all I know now, but I don't think he is. The straightforward truth of the statement, "I am still alive," cannot be guaranteed. It might no longer be true. It might also be, as in the title of my presentation today, a quote. Oh, hang on, too fast. Okay. Kawara's declaration that he is still alive, whether actually true or not, is more than simply a statement of fact. It is a testimony. It testifies to something. It is making a declaration of some truth. And as such, as Derrida puts it, it is an act. It is not simply reflecting some prior truth, but declaring something to be true, and in doing so, in a sense, making it true. When Derrida talks of an act, he is alluding to the Oxford philosopher, and there he is, smoking a pipe, I love that picture, J.L. Austin's notion of speech acts, utterances that do things rather than simply describe a pre-existing state of affairs. Austin calls such utterances, as well as speech acts, he also calls them performatives, as opposed to constatives, things which are merely statements that merely describe things. Okay. In his book, in which he described this particular set of affairs, called How to Do Things with Words, Austin was most concerned with how to maintain the difference between genuine or felicitous speech acts and those that are unfelicitous, accidental, inappropriate, or, as he puts it, parasitical. They parasite upon the genuine speech act in order to have their effect. So a classic example of a felicitous speech act, one which I myself have actually done, is to say, I do in a wedding ceremony, at which point you are actually married. That statement has actually made something happen. Among the infelicitous examples of speech acts would be a performance of the wedding ceremony on stage, where it is actually not, doesn't actually make the supposed act happen, especially when not performed by those without the right or power to do so. So Derrida suggests that felicitous speech acts are only made possible by the existence of those to which Austin opposed them. And he says, in signature event context, a standard act depends as much upon the possibility of being repeated and thus potentially of being mimed, feigned, cited, played, simulated, parasited, etc., as the latter possibility depends on the possibility of said to be opposed to it. So you cannot separate out the performative and the constative as far as Derrida is concerned. Following Derrida's lead, J. Hillis Miller, who I quoted earlier, J. Hillis Miller, the conception of and distinctions between the performative and the constative that Austin makes are still bound up with what he calls the perdurable, unitary, freely willing ego, which is, quote, a concomitant of the age of the printed book, unquote, which was the age and context in which Descartes expanded his conception of the separate self-conscious ego in the famous cogito ergo sum, and which also is the time in which our notion of the museum or gallery began to emerge as itself a kind of simulacrum, if you like, or a kind of model of this inside-outside model of the sort of cogito. Okay. Derrida, according to Hillis Miller, on the other hand, already belongs to the age of cyberspace. For him, the self is multitudinous and variable, permeable, remade from moment to moment by speech acts. His recent work challenges the concept of the citizen located in one topographically delimited polis. This concept was sustained by print media with their fact, fiction, real, imaginary, inside, outside, private, public dichotomies. The Cartesian self of the age of the book is now being replaced by the televisionary or cinematic or internet self, who dwells within a new transnational regime of telecommunications. That regime is a place of spectral, fleeting, impermanent selves, created and decreated by media. Kawara, too, belongs to the age of cyberspace and the new transnational regime of telecommunications, even as he only communicates the older forms of telecommunications media. This can be seen in the performative act of sending telegrams, in which not just his continued living existence, but his very identity is anxiously declared and insisted upon. If his identity and his existence were self-evident or assured, simply matters of fact to be constitutively affirmed, why is it necessary to keep attesting to them? Much the same can be said about the cards he has been sending since 1968, with a stamped message about the time he got up that day. They, too, anxiously assert, testify to the continued existence of Kawara himself. Again, the fact that he got up means implicitly that he is still alive, that from card to card, from location to location, some entity that is able to sign himself on Kawara endures and persists, even as he finds himself in endless different locations. Part of their appeal is the enigmatic nature of the message, which, being on a postcard, is visible for anyone to read. Somebody who encountered one of these postcards without knowing who Onkanara is or was would be free to speculate what the message meant. They might ask whether it's some kind of code, a message, or a message to a lover. Yet, despite his sensitivity to the transformations made possible by media, in the way we live and think, Kawara himself was not particularly interested in new media itself. He has ceased to send the telegrams because the telegram system has largely been replaced by email. He has also ceased to send the postcards because, apparently, somebody stole the rubber stamp. Nor, for all his interest in the effects of media, Derrida is particularly wired himself. In a late interview with the Cahiers de Médiologie, Derrida confessed that, "I use a computer, of course, but I don't do email, I don't surf the internet." Nevertheless, Hillis Miller suggests that one of Derrida's main points in the postcard is that it is a feature of the new regime of telecommunications to break down the inside-outside dichotomies that presides over the old print culture. The new regime is ironically allegorized in his book, The Postcard, in somewhat obsolete forms. That is, not only in the many telephone conversations the protagonist or protagonists have with their beloved or beloveds, but also in an old-fashioned remnant of the rapidly disappearing culture of handwriting, print and the post system, the postcard. The postcard stands as a proleptic anticipation of the publicity and openness of the new communications regime. Again, goodbye privacy. And to continue, the breakdown of the traditional boundaries between inside and outside brought about by new communication technologies. As this epochal cultural displacement from the book age to the hypertext age has accelerated, we have, in Derrida's view, been ushered ever more rapidly into a threatening living space. This new electronic space, the space of television, cinema, telephone, videos, fax, email, hypertext, internet, has profoundly altered, and I'm quoting Hillis Miller again, the economies of the self, the home, the workplace, university, and the nation state's politics. These were traditionally ordered around firm boundaries and inside-outside dichotomy. Whether those boundaries were the walls between the home's privacy and all the world outside, or the borders between the nation state and its neighbours, these new technologies invade the home of the nation. They confound all these inside-outside divisions. Well, that is actually from Videodrome, as you probably know, but it's, you know, kind of an illustration of this. And to add to this list of the home, the workplace, the self, the university, nation state, one might again add the museum or gallery, the white cube. Here, represented by the Whitney Museum of American Art. And again, all these museums are classic spaces of containment, of inside-outside. They absolutely exemplify still this idea of a certain kind of cultural space filled with certain kinds of things that is absolutely resistant to the kinds of things that net art is beginning to sort of indicate and bring about. But yet, even as something like the Whitney exemplifies the idea of the gallery as an interior space separated from the exterior world, the Whitney's borders are breached by the web, confounding the inside-outside dichotomies upon which the gallery is traditionally founded. And so, to take a particular example, here is Christian Paul's Art Port. I'm sure many of you are familiar with this, which is the Whitney's portal or space in which you can have access to net art. And of course, it exactly sits or trembles both as part of the gallery inside and yet accessible from, and in a way, because it's in the public space, the net outside. It absolutely confounds the kind of inside-outside dichotomy that the web or the gallery is based on. Okay. It's admittedly not a large part of the Whitney's provision, but it is an indication of a kind of beginning of a deconstruction of those borders, if you like. So, one might say, perhaps, a little bit cheekily, that net art deconstructs the traditional space of the museum. And perhaps like Derrida, and even like Ted Nelson, the great deconstructionist of the 20th century, meets a considerable and perhaps understandable resistance in doing so. Yet, even as galleries resist, marginalise or incorporate net art only at the very edges of their space in the broadest sense, they are in themselves being transformed, are being changed in response to a new regime of telecommunications that net art comes to symptomise, comes to represent. No longer absolutely the closed separate spaces of the Cartesian era, they are becoming increasingly porous, albeit somewhat slowly. Tate Gallery, for example, the major gallery of contemporary art in the United Kingdom, has expanded its remit far beyond the normal conception of the gallery's role, even if, so far, it is still concerned with, as far as most people are concerned, its primary business is still physically displaying static unitary works of art. Yet, much of what it does now is closer to the kinds of activities traditionally associated with schools, or art schools, or universities, or institutions such as the Institute of Contemporary Arts, or even broadcasting companies. And it's sad that Kelly Dipple, who is actually the webcasting curator from Tate, was here earlier but had to go and get a plane, because she indeed was telling me last night about some of the extraordinary things that are beginning to happen at the Tate. And some ways, parts of it are thinking themselves now more as a kind of broadcasting entity than a traditional museum. Okay. So in some ways, in a sense, like the paradigmatic post-industrial company, Tate is transforming itself from an institution concerned primarily with things to one concerned with information and knowledge and all the ramifications of that particular transformation. Okay, just about to finish, amazingly. So this all puts the presence of net art in galleries such as Tate and Whitney and elsewhere in a different light. Rather than being no more than a marginal form of art practice shoved to the edges as part of a process of incorporation and domestication, they are possibly a symptom and harbinger of the changes taking place in the gallery as an institution in this new regime of telecommunications, brought about in part at least by technological developments such as the internet and the World Wide Web. These shifts are already, in ways we perhaps don't fully understand or recognise, radically changing how we think about the gallery as an institution, about art as a practice, as a form of cultural expression, and quite possibly about many other aspects of our social and cultural existence. Thank you.
You were so fast that we can have like a 5-minute discussion, so we're taking up time here. So, a very interesting point for me, where I totally agree, is to have this non-technical prehistory of communication art, including mail and including other possibilities of communication. And you mentioned some examples. So for me, the most important prehistory heroes might be two. On Kavara, you talked about him, and the other one would be Ray Johnson. And if we stick to those two, maybe the problem that net art is confronting compared to the gallery system, and that was I was trying to evoke in making the introduction to your talk, can be exemplified even without talking about the net, but just by pointing at these two artists. Because Onkawara made a terrible great career in the framework of conceptual art, because he never thought about it as a communicative act which is open and responsive, but about a very rigid conceptual system of this sending postcards. And the opposite would be Ray Johnson, who really thought about a network of founding this school and of the art of sharing that Mark Rees talked about. He would be the prehistory of years before the examples that you have been showing in the world of technology. And typically, he made not very much of a career and jumped off a bridge in one of his saddest moments. And even after that, not very much happened. So I was waiting for now the big Ray Johnson boom to come up, because he was a little bit in a way of his career himself, because he was a very complicated person to deal with. I tried to make a Ray Johnson show a couple of times, and he never won it. So we have these two examples of the one who by will takes himself out of the production of artifacts that might be part of the museum and value-creating art market system, and the one that feeds in through a conceptual filter.
Okay. Firstly, there's a very funny story about Ray Johnson that kind of actually exemplifies also what I'm saying. Is Johnson discovered or found out that if you send a letter to the Museum of Modern Art, they are from an artist, they will always catalogue and keep it. So he sent lots of letters to MoMA, knowing that at the very least they would have that in the, you know, those letters in his collection. Of course, they were being communications, they were works of art, as far as he was concerned. So that's not just funny. He's actually perfectly exemplifying a sort of deconstruction of the borders of the museum in a kind of ironic, cheeky way. My point about, you're absolutely right about Kawawa, is he wouldn't have seen himself as a precursor or even a sort of person connected with the practices that Martin was talking about, the sort of things that are happening at the same time. I saw him more as a kind of anxious symptom, who nevertheless played within the art the art game rules very effectively, as you rightly say, and his works are absolutely museum works. But it's more that the time he was beginning to do what he did, the time Johnson was beginning to do what he did, the time that people like Douglas Davis, and Ray Ascott were doing their work, all come at the same time, where a kind of crisis of culture, I think, is emerging as a result of technological change, and which is symptomized a number of different ways. And I think what Kawara catches is a certain kind of neurotic symptom about the self in relation to the artwork and about relation to time. There's a lot to be said about his always taking his works in a very specific moment, either the dating of the postcard or the dating of the painting or the dating of the telegram, which goes against a certain understanding of art as being outside of time in a certain way. So you're absolutely right. He doesn't actively or consciously prefigure the kinds of communicative aspects of net art exactly, but he does capture other things that might be forgotten if that's the only genealogy we actually, you know, would actually adhere to.
I just add on one more thing on Ray Johnson, because most people may never have heard about him, which links back to what Lev Manovich has been saying, that in his work he also has this idea of the recombination of various sources. So he asks artists to give him pieces of their work to incorporate it in his mail messages, and he sends that to a third person and asks that to cut it in four and send it to again four other persons and to add on their own work. So it is a multimedia layering and is a production reception process which is very complicated and creates throughout a social network something where he really loses control of what is happening in the end, you know. And that is maybe a little bit closer to this part of the multimedia world that Lev has been talking about. Yeah, okay. So sorry, we don't want to bore you with the 1960s pioneers, but still I find it very important, precisely in the context of Ars Electronica, that its history of ideas is not limiting itself to certain technologies, but the ideas are there in many, many other possibilities and media, and that links back to what Florian Kramer has been presenting in the morning. Yet you could sometimes go back to even much longer periods. Maybe we have two questions from the public, if there are any, to Charlie. Okay, one in the back from Andreas.
Thank you. Thanks for a really great talk. I would like to pick up on the question about the museums. You were mentioning two male artists, and I think that might be part of the problem, that that scene is really small,
yeah.
And the way in which the art world works is that two are not really a movement, and the movement was so small and thin that might be part of the problem for the male art thing. My real question is about the museums. You mentioned two museums. I'm going to ask, can you name five more that are actually active in that field? Or then I thought maybe I should ask the question like this. Can you name more that are actually actively supporting net art than you can name museums that have abandoned net art within the last 10 years?
Well, I think we
because
can all do...
Yeah. I think that the two that you were mentioning, they may be pioneers, but they may also be the tail end of a development where the museum world tried things out, and it's thanks to somebody like Christiane, who is, you know, holding up that flag, and the moment that something happens, like with Steve Dietz, then that whole thing is going to be gone.
I mean, in a way, the two questions are kind of connected, and part of my point about the museum is it resists net art. And we all know about Steve Dietz being sacked from the Walker and all that. And the sort of incredibly mealy-mouthed and sort of partial way a place like Tate does stuff, despite the advocacy of people within it and the Whitney. My point is actually, despite itself, weirdly, or despite themselves, museums and galleries as entities are changing to become, you know, to sort of become much more like the kinds of things that they marginalise. So, in a way, what you're getting with a lot of these practices that don't get recognised by the museum is that they are too soon. And precisely male art, which actually was bigger than that, because, you know, Johnson was part of a network, or he was related to other kind of networks like the Fluxus, used mail out quite a lot, and the New Varial East and so forth. So in a way, they are the kind of the symptom that comes once but needs to come twice to be recognised, in a sort of Freudian Nachtraglik moment. It's a kind of and the very fact, in a way, my thesis would collapse if these points were recognised, because it is the very fact that they open out a new space that they can only recognise in sort of, après coup, afterwards, that sort of gives them their point. And it's why we have to keep going back to recover those lost moments that have got lost, almost structurally, because of what they do. Because they recognise something's happening that museums, galleries, by their very nature, can't recognise, because they're structured designed to sort of deal with stable situations or deal with things as they get historically recognised. I think this is a very important point about this, the smallness of the kinds of things that went on. On the other hand, if you were living in the 1870s, you would not have heard of the Impressionists. You'd be going off to the sort of salon looking at the, Artist Pompier. You would not be what we now recognize as being important. It's always a kind of backward view, in a funny way, and it's a continual process of re-recognition by which Johnson may have failed to recognize his Titanic committed suicide, he jumped off the bridge and all that, but, now we're recognizing him, because the world we now live in is a world which he enables us to recognize and think about. So I think there's a complex historical thing going on that doesn't just stop at the failure to recognize those people at the moment they were practicing. Unfortunately for them, unfortunately for Johnson, he didn't get the recognition he deserved at the time, possibly. Maybe partly because he was quite difficult as a person, as you've said.
Okay, Mel left just, but very short, and a very short answer, because I see Verena is getting kind of into movement. Yeah, you have your part then. Okay.
Well, I think that the art world and the culture at large has fundamentally changed, let's say, in the last 12 years. So, it was one thing in that art in 95, when the art market was still depressed after the, 87 collapse. It's another thing to do today where, because of globalization, where a new museum is being opened every day, the art market, is doing, better than ever. It became very fashionable and hip to become a painter. It's like a serious career because you can make millions of dollars. And with this decade, the smart artists, the smart ones, don't become media artists. They just become normal artists, and they use media. They just don't announce it, right? So we can join the art world and get benefits of collectors, sort of catalogs, etc. So to that extent, it's a very different situation. So I think when we had a kind of previous question about museums kind of pulling away from net art, we didn't pull away from net art, we just kind of pulled more towards contemporary art where people use different media, but where emphasis is on content, let's say social communication, talking about political issues, and the issue of media is really kind of secondary. So I think in some ways, the smart people don't call themselves net artists anymore, right? So we can actually have a commercial career.
Yeah. If I look at the proposal by Verena, I think she will answer that question. Is that right for you?
Well, I just make a very quick answer. I think you're absolutely right, and I think there's an interesting sort of historical dynamic between the opening out of a medium in its first instance that you might see in the early video art, which is a lot about the medium itself, and now it's sort of second wind as a kind of just another medium artists use, often in concert with other things, but is incorporated in the gallery. So I think there may be, one might posit certain kinds of recognizable historical stages in how a medium emerges, is recognized, is kind of investigated, and then becomes, to some extent, normalized, possibly. That's an answer, briefly. Okay, and I'll stop there. Thank you.